Blondes with glasses, they can't sing. Blondes with glasses, let's do this podcast thing.
Hey, Shannon.
Hey, Becca.
Oh, okay. So just to prepare the listeners, I might sneeze, and I'm going to reach for that mute button if I feel a sneeze coming on, but I need to dust my apartment is the moral of the story.
Yeah, dusting your apartment is great because you can do it when you're listening to podcasts.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I will do any part of cleaning my apartment that isn't vacuuming because I can listen to podcasts while I do it. And vacuuming, it's like, ugh. Even though it takes, like, I don't know, 5 minutes because I have a 500 square foot apartment.
Yeah.
But still, it's like, well, I can't be entertained for those 5 minutes. I just have to work. Ugh.
Awful. Oh, yeah. My gosh. So we wanted to start off today talking about soccer, right?
Yeah. it's a part of soccer that dovetails perfectly into our podcast. Which
Does it?
Yeah, just because it's like women in media.
General,
oh,
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Our general. I thought you had this week's topic of La La Land.
No, not exactly.
No, okay, yes. So, yes, women in media.
Right,
yes.
So like there was this huge announcement Thursday that the NWSL is teaming up with A&E Networks, a.k.a. Lifetime, which did you know A&E Networks is owned by Disney? Because what don't they own?
I think I did know that, yeah. Yes.
Anyway, so their Lifetime and NWSL will be, like, Lifetime is going to be an equity partner with the league. They're going to show a game a week for the entire season. They're going to be in charge of the streaming and the broadcast quality, and they're going to come up with an app that tracks stats and things like that. And so it's, like, basically, like, the best possible deal for this league, and it's so fantastic. I'm so excited about it, and I think it's a really great deal. And then, of course, there has to be at least one person who writes a dumb article about Lifetime. That's a channel for women. And it drove me insane, so I immediately had to email you and be like, what is it with people thinking that marketing to women is excluding men and that everything we do for men doesn't actively exclude women already? You know, like the idea that by catering to women means that we're telling men you're not allowed in this space. Like, when have we ever told men you're not allowed in this space? And when have they ever listened if we have said that?
Yeah, that's a good point. Lilith Fair is the only thing I can think of where men are not allowed.
And women's colleges, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Even that's getting blurry.
Extent. Yeah, but...
But, like, when the women's march happened and people were like, can men come? It's like, yeah, of course. Like, relax. Who cares?
I just think, like, imagine the reverse of this article that you read that made you so mad, which is like somebody writing an article about the Super Bowl, which is happening this weekend, the day that this episode comes out, and it's like, why aren't women allowed on to watch the Super Bowl? Like, I can't even imagine the opposite version of this, like, this story, because this happens all the time. Like, didn't you say that the WNBA used to be hosted on Lifetime as well? That's amazing.
Right.
I never knew that.
And it's like, yeah, it's such a great place to start. And sure, it's like, and it's also, it really leads me to start thinking about, we can totally reinvent the entire way that we go about presenting sports to the world. Like, if at least women's sports, like, there is absolutely no reason that we have to adhere to the model that men's sports have left us, because that's not a perfect model. It excludes, it feels very exclusive. It took years for women to, like, crawl their way into sports fandoms, and they're still disrespected on every level of being a men's sports fan. And so now we have this opportunity to say, okay, well, we don't even need to be on ESPN or whatever and have them, like, have commentators who are like, I don't really watch the league, but, you know, I work for ESPN, so here I am commenting, and, like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. Or we could have Lifetime, a channel that doesn't do sports at all, but they understand, well, we can market this. It's not purely sports. It's exciting stories. It's like, what else do we love about sports, and can we acknowledge, like, how interesting that is, and, like, how interesting these women are and dynamic and interesting they are, instead of just being like, oh, and now we have this weird spectacle of a woman's league. Like, that's, like, tacked on to our exclusively male coverage of sports.
Yeah, I think this actually is like a wider phenomenon with a lot of niche channels in America, which is like, this applies to almost any other channel you can think of that's not marketed to towards like men.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think of like ABC Family used to have this sort of thing where it's like, can good programming come from channels that you think of as lesser?
Right,
so
like, or the CW. MTV.
Yeah, the CW, MTV, like all of these little tiny channels that are owned by the same parent companies that everybody else is watching.
Right.
But at the same time are producing these TV shows that people are obsessed with, you know, like Samantha Bee is not on a major network. Mm-hmm. Like all these things where you're like, is it so bad that these other networks are hosting these voices?
Right.
And like, why does it matter? Like, if a man wants to watch women's soccer, great.
Yeah.
Why is it a big deal if he has to tune into Lifetime?
Right. Like, how is it this affront to his masculinity to be like, I want to like watch sports and be a sports fan, but I feel totally excluded because women watch it too.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm just thinking about this from like an outsider's perspective, knowing that we have listeners in Ireland who do not understand like that Lifetime has this burden upon it as like the women's network.
Yeah.
Like that it is only for like soapy dramas and like I Killed My Husband
and Dance
movies.
Moms.
Dance Moms, stuff like that. You know, like I can't imagine listening to this without the knowledge of Lifetime,
right.
Like this aura around the channel, because it sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like that men won't watch this channel just because. You know?
Right. But instead of this idea that, like, who cares if men become fans of the NWSL? Like, truly, I do not care. What I care about is, what about all those women who aren't sports fans at all who would be mm-hmm. totally interested in this mm-hmm. in this product? And that every Saturday at 4 p.m. on Lifetime this summer, there's going to be an NWSL game. And it's going to be broadcast well. And it's going to be presumably, I assume, covered and, like, commented on by people who actually know the league. And mm-hmm. they're going to package it in a way that says, look at this really cool product that we have. Women, like, don't you want to get invested in this story? This, like, season-long arc of mm-hmm. who's going to win the championship and, you know, what's going on in these different areas? And, like, I just think that's so much richer to me, is tapping into that untapped market who rejected men's sports because it's actively rejected them, and they thought, mm-hmm. there's no way, like, what is the appeal of that? Like, I don't get the appeal of most men's sports, honestly. I feel actively rejected from that group, versus the NWSL just, like, welcomed me into this warm embrace, and it's such a fun hobby, and I think that's so much of a more interesting avenue to go down than, say, converting men's sports fans, and men in particular, into mm-hmm. supporting us. Like, who cares? Like, we don't need them to survive. The NFL right now, if they lost women, which is 45% of their viewership, they would not be doing well. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, they need to do better with women if they want to survive.
Well, it's great. I'm very excited for you and all of your NWSL fans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll definitely tune in if I'm near a cable television that has the channel. I will tune in for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. And when they do stream it, every other game that isn't
yes.
the game of the week, it's going to be free and like available worldwide. It won't be geo-blocked at all, just like it was on YouTube every other season. So that's huge.
Yeah.
I'm happy with every part of this deal. And who would have thought?
And most importantly, I think, is because of this deal, the players are getting paid more. Right?
Yeah. I mean, basically because you're bringing in an equity partner who's buying a stake of this company, you know, like this organization, that they can infuse a ton of cash.
Mm.
And they're a Disney, you know, subsidiary. So they have money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's overall some great news to come out of this week.
Yeah.
I'm just happy we can share it with
news.
People.
Yeah,
yeah, it's nice. Now let's talk about the movie you hated.
It's funny, when the movie ended, I saw it with my friend Hannah.
La La Land.
La La
we're talking
Land,
about
by
La
the way.
Land.
Yeah. When the movie ended, we turned to each other and we're like, okay. I'm like, okay, let's, you know, like, soak it in. Let's think about it. And we walk out of the theater and then we just immediately are like, what? Like, we were just angry. And then as the week progressed after I saw it, I was just angrier and angrier. And I find less and less things I liked about it as time goes on.
Do you want to just, like, start out telling me, like, generally what you were not into about it?
I didn't think it qualified as a musical.
Okay.
I thought there were very few musical numbers. I thought Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone can't really sing or dance, which is a huge requirement, especially if your entire aesthetic is going to be a callback to classic Hollywood musicals, where they sung and danced like the greatest you've ever seen in your life. Like Gene Kelly, like Debbie Reynolds, like the most talented singers and dancers you've ever seen in your life. And I thought it was too slow, too long. And I thought the music was completely unremarkable, especially for a musical. I thought it had one song that it kept repeating multiple times.
Yeah.
I thought the white guy wanting to save jazz was utter bullshit. I thought it was like the whitest story in the world. I thought this is a completely unnecessary story that needed to be told. Like we've talked about in previous episodes, you quoted Mo Ryan saying, "Is this story necessary?" You know, like when you're looking at a TV show, a movie, or whatever, you're assessing, you know, saying, "Does it do something new? Does it say something new? Like, does it add value to our society? You know, in any way? Does it do anything new?" And I would argue it does nothing new. It's completely unnecessary, and it provides nothing.
Yeah. I agree on pretty much every point you've made. However, I feel like I have some insider knowledge, which will maybe put a little band-aid on your feelings about this. Because, okay, so before I saw this movie, you had seen it, Perry had seen it, my dad and Laura had seen it, and everybody was telling me, like, this was not what I was expecting, this is not a musical, all this stuff. And after my dad and Laura saw it, they are super obsessed with Turner Classic Movies, the channel. Mm-hmm. And they watch that, I think, every night. If it's not that, it's HGTV. But so they were watching it one night, and the host of the night was the director of this movie, La La Land.
Yeah.
And Damien Chazelle. Yeah. Which is, that's a great last name. Just Chazelle. Anyway. So he was the host of the night. And basically when you're the host, like, Drew Barrymore did it a month ago for, like, the Barrymore night or whatever. So when you're the host, you pick the movies, and you do a little stand-up before and after each movie, and you say, like, this is the movie I picked, this is why I picked it, this is why it's important to me. And so he picked a couple movies that directly related to La La Land.
Right, like, that that's he was why referencing.
Yeah, and he was like, these are the ones that I picked because my movie is nominated for Oscars, and that's why I'm on here. And all the movies he picked were French Golden Age musicals, not American.
Yeah.
And my dad sat through the first one, and it's The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is from 1964. And he said, as soon as he, like, first of all, it was like pulling teeth watching it.
Yeah. But
as soon as he sat through that movie, he got it. And he was like, the whole problem for him specifically was he went in thinking he was going to see Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
And what he should have gone in thinking was, I'm going to see The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Mm-hmm. Because they are two different golden ages, and everybody was expecting American, and what happened was French. And as soon as he told me that, I saw the movie like a week or two later, and I went in with such low expectations because of everything that everybody had told me. And knowing that, and comparing it to the very few French films I've seen over the years, I was like, okay, I get it. So I, like, kind of enjoyed it. And is that the ghost again?
Was that you or me?
That was
what
you.
What fell?
That happened last time. There is a ghost joining us each week now.
I don't know what is happening in my apartment. Anyway.
It's the dust. The dust is moving in. Anyway, so I kind of enjoyed it because my expectations were so low, and I was relating it to the French films that I have enjoyed in the past.
Okay.
And I think because of that, I was, like, okay with it. However, the best thing I saw online about this movie was some, I think it was a tweet, and it was like, La La Land is the modern version of Shakespeare in Love. And I was like, that just sums it up so perfectly, because Shakespeare in Love was nominated in, like, 1998, something like that, for 13 Oscars. And it won 7 of them. And nobody talks about that movie anymore.
I love that movie.
I mean, I also really
enjoy that movie. That's a genuinely good movie.
Not to an extent that it's, like, Oscar nobility. Like, that was nominated for 13 Oscars. And still people, it's, like, not mentioned, except for the fact that Judi Dench won her Oscar for, like, the shortest amount of time on screen ever. It was, like, 12 minutes
on screen. I have no memory of her in that movie.
She's the queen. Oh, she's barely okay, in it. She's in, like, one scene. And so...
I understand. It's in the sense that it's an Oscar... It's a movie that got nominated for a lot of Oscars that isn't a slug, like, it isn't a slog to get through. It isn't, well, it kind of is, but it isn't, like, a biopic that's really sad. And that's unusual for Oscar-heavy movies, is that they're heavy movies. Mm-hmm. And so I get sort of that connection, but to me, the reason why this was nominated for so many Oscars is because it's a Hollywood up its own butt movie. And they love those. They love letters to Hollywood. I just think, as far as love letters to Hollywood goes, it's a pretty shitty one. Like, it is. Like, because it's referencing French movies. It's but it's also reminding you of Hollywood. It's also reminding you of Singing in the Rain in certain scenes. It's going to the Griffith Observatory. It's Hollywood. They go to the back lots. I mean, honestly, I think at some point there's a Roman centurion walking along in the Warner Brothers lot. Like, it's the most cliche Hollywood up its own butt movie, and yet it's not referencing Hollywood movies, it's referencing French movies, and we're supposed to still think, what a beautiful love letter to Hollywood. We pick these two actors who are good actors and have chemistry but can't sing or dance. And it's just, to me it's half of an attempt, you know?
Do you know who was originally slated to play those roles? Did you hear this story?
No, who?
Originally, it was going to be Miles Teller and Emma Watson.
Ew, what?
Think about that. Gross. So, Miles Teller worked with Damien Chazelle on Whiplash, which was also Oscar nominated. And Emma Watson was going to be Emma Stone's role, but she had to drop out because of conflicts with Beauty and the Beast's filming.
And she was going to, play small town Nebraska girl or whatever, you know, Nevada girl. And he was going to be the jazz asshole.
Yeah, again. Like, okay.
like, the only reason you didn't actively really hate Ryan Gosling's character is because Ryan Gosling is so charming.
Right. But here's the thing about, and I spent the entire movie thinking, was thinking
my way out of the paper. You had a lot of time to think through the movie, because nothing was happening.
Think your way out of a paper bag. Like, let's get through this morass here and, like, get out. So I was thinking so much. I was like, Ryan Gosling, why? Like, because I absolutely love 100,000,000% the movie Crazy Stupid Love with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. I love that movie. I watch it a ton. I have it on DVD. It's right there. I can get it out right now. Yeah. It is so good. I love them together. And I was trying to figure out why that is not in this movie, in La La Land. Like, what's missing? And I was like, I think what the problem is Ryan Gosling is not an earnest actor, where he doesn't have that sense where he can relate to the audience and tell you, like, this is what I care about. You also have to care about it now. Because not for one second for that whole film did I buy the fact that he loved jazz. There was never a moment where I was like, oh yeah, this is his life. Like, he can't live without it. And so, and when he was playing the piano, I was like, oh wow, Ryan Gosling really learned how to play piano.
Yeah.
I was looking at the film as if I was watching Ryan Gosling. And when I was watching the SAG Awards and thinking about La La Land and hearing Mahershala Ali speak on stage and thinking about him in Moonlight and thinking about him in Hidden Figures, I was like, he's an actor that has earnestness, and also he is Black. Oh my God, he would have been the perfect actor for this role.
Honestly, just imagine this movie without two white leads. I mean, it would, like, imagine her whole struggle throughout the movie is being an actress, you know, in Hollywood, and how difficult that is and how much rejection you face or whatever. Imagine what, like, that, see, this is the part where it becomes, is this movie necessary? And mm-hmm. if you change the leads to two people of color, it becomes instantly necessary and something yep. worth saying. Because then you're saying, not only is she getting the door slammed in her face when she's doing auditions, but she's auditioning for the most stereotypical roles, or they're asking her to be more stereotypically black or something in her auditions. You know, like, you could really mm-hmm. say something about what is wrong with Hollywood. And with him trying to save jazz, it would actually make sense and not yeah. be incredibly offensive to have mm-hmm. him love jazz and want to save it. And the idea that also, that his nightclub did so well, like, I don't believe it for a second. Like, and honestly, John Legend's argument partway through the movie where he's like, yeah, jazz is dying and this is the only way to save it is to mm-hmm. change it into something different and modernize it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, that's a really strong argument. Mm-hmm. You know, like, but the movie treated that as garbage, like, nonsense, and how dare you,
John Legend,
that you would say that about our beautiful jazz. And so it's just everything about this movie just was so proud of itself, and mm-hmm. all those awards shows when Damien Chazelle would get the award and he would say, 6 years of people saying no to this movie and mm-hmm. what a struggle it's been to make it or whatever, and it's nominated for all these awards because Hollywood loves itself. Like, of course this movie got made. Like, it's mm-hmm. not, it wasn't a struggle because it was two white people, you know, telling a story that we've all heard 1,000 times that is uninteresting, and I didn't even buy their love story. Like,
yeah,
their meeting was like, they didn't like each other, he seemed like a real dick. They didn't have anything in common, and then they sort of did some weird little soft shoe dancing together, and then
they liked each other,
and then everything else was like silent film, and then it was like, oh, and then it doesn't work out. You know, like, I hated this movie. I really did.
Would you have hated it more if it had been Miles Teller and Emma Watson?
1,000%. I don't know that I would have even bothered to see it if it was those two people.
Yeah,
I think Emma Stone is a brilliant comedic actress, mm-hmm. and I think she is so good, and she can be so funny, and she's also a very good dramatic actress. I just think she can't, she like, they both can technically sing, but they cannot sing, you know what I mean?
Right.
Same with dancing. Like, they brought nothing to the table dancing or singing-wise, and it just, to me, it didn't make any sense, their casting. Mm.
Well, at the same time I was thinking about Ryan Gosling in his role, I was also thinking about Emma Stone in her role. And the whole time, I was just haunted by Anna Kendrick.
Right.
Because I recently fell in love with The Last 5 Years, the album, and also the movie version mm-hmm. that she was in. And Anna Kendrick's character in that movie/that show is basically the exact same role. It's a struggling actress who, although for Broadway, you know, but she's attached to a much more successful male artist, and it's them struggling, and they fail at the end. Like, that is, it's the same mm-hmm. story, it's the same woman character, but Anna, knowing how successful Anna Kendrick was in that role, in that movie version, the whole time I was like, I really wish Anna Kendrick was playing this role, because I know uh-huh. she did it so well already, and, like, that's boring for her. Obviously, she doesn't want to play this role, but, like, I know she can sing, I know she can dance, and also, she would make me cry, because she did make me cry in the last 5 years. So I was thinking about Mahershala Ali and Anna Kendrick in this movie, and I was like, yes, that's the movie I wanted to see.
I just wanted to see people who could sing and dance.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear music that was memorable. I wanted to tell you something about the songs other than City of Stars. Literally, that line is the only thing I can remember. And that is a nice little line, a nice little hook mm-hmm. to it. And I can't tell you anything else about the rest of the song, because it was so unmemorable to me.
Yeah.
And I just think the fact that two of the songs from that movie, which the only two songs in the movie, let's be honest, mm-hmm. were nominated for Oscars.
For best song,
is egregious and offensive.
I have been burned so many times before by best song and best score at the Oscars, because I have very strong opinions about specifically best score mm-hmm. for some reason. And I remember the year that Inception, no, sorry, not, The Social Network won best score.
Yeah.
I was livid because literally any other movie in that category, I would have been like, yes. Because it was like Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, The King's Speech. Like, I owned every other score that was nominated that year. And I was like, these are all brilliant. And they all lost to The Social Network, which was just Atticus Ross or whatever.
Trent Reznor.
Just like, yeah, mm-hmm. just like bzz, that bzz noise over and over again. And I was, so if this year, if one of these two songs wins best song over Moana, I will cry.
Yeah.
And then curl up in the fetal position and listen to Moana for months. What? And I will not stop.
with award shows like this, you start to feel like you're living in an alternate dimension where you're like, did we see the same movie? You know, sort of a thing. Like, what are we talking about here? That those were good songs. You know, like, yeah, they're songs from a movie musical. Is that the only criteria it takes to get into the best song category? Like, it's just bonkers.
Obviously not. To answer that question directly, that's obviously not the only criteria, because last year, Lady Gaga was nominated for a documentary. Yeah. There are plenty of documentaries
for a song
that
played
great songs
for the credits.
Yeah,
although,
exactly.
And also Melissa Etheridge in Inconvenient Truth, the song played
yes.
the credits.
So, Why?
Why? Just like last year with The Revenant, where it was just like, are we living in an alternate world? In which, at least with that one, you were like, okay, it was a struggle physically to do that, you know, sort of a thing. And like, and there was nice shots of woods. I don't know. Like, it just feels like the Oscar voters and me just don't, we're not living in the same universe.
Yeah. Well, I have a larger sort of theory about this movie in the Oscars pantheon, and so I'm gonna try and explain it to you right now. So, in 2009, the Oscars expanded the Best Picture category to include up to 10 nominees, and ever since 2009, basically half of the years since then have had an abundance of, I would say, quote unquote, artistic movies represented, and so. They, like, this includes, like, 2014, which had The Grand Budapest Hotel, Boyhood, Whiplash, and Birdman all nominated that year, and Birdman won Best Picture. And also 2011, which had The Tree of Life, Hugo, Midnight in Paris, and The Artist won that year. So I really see why, on top of the it's Hollywood loving itself principle, I really see why La La Land is in the Best Picture category, because when they expanded it, they made room for films that were no longer biopics or really hard to get through, you know, war films, things like that. And they expanded to let these movies in, which is something that people wanted, because there were so many years where people were like, all these great films got left behind because there wasn't enough room. But at the same time, I can't add up what I know about the film, what I saw about the film, with the fact that it is now tied for the record of most Oscar nominations. It has 14 Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
And that is baffling to me, because there is so much about it where I'm like, okay, I get it. Cinematography, sure. Production design, sure. Like, there is all these ones that are artistic merits that I get, but I don't get other things, like best two nominations for best song. Like, I don't get it, and I always thought
that the best movie of the year, the one that wins the best picture, also is nominated in a myriad of categories, because that means that it was best on every level, and in this case, rewarding La La Land on so many levels is so insane to me, because yes, maybe it ekes into best picture because it's this Hollywood movie and it's a musical and it does something a little different and it's French or whatever. It's like The Artist or whatever. It sort of gets in there and you're like, okay, it's this artistic movie. But in every other category, like, that's so insane. Like, okay, can we, like, break this movie down from the beginning where it starts off with this sequence, this, like, traffic sequence in L.A. And it's like, I just feel like it can't decide, does it hate L.A.? Is it like a positive view? I don't know, whatever. But like, the singing and dancing aren't even good for like all of those people. Like, the song, I couldn't really hear it that well.
It was really hard
to hear. It was really hard to hear. The sound mixing was garbage in that. And I it's not like I'm just not going to remember any of the singing, dancing, whatever. It's none of it is going to stick with me. It's not like one of those movies where you go to LA and you're like, ah, this is that scene from La La Land, you know? It's like, no, that is not one of the movies you're going to think of.
I think this is going to be an Avatar situation, where 5 years from now, everybody forgets this movie existed, mm-hmm. except for the fact that it holds a record.
True.
Because you can't quote Avatar. Nobody knows a quote from Avatar. And, like, nobody's going to know a quote from La La Land.
Mm-mm. I mean, I couldn't tell you one now, and I watched it 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, same. City of Stars.
City of Stars. Yeah.
Maybe we just don't understand because we don't live in L.A. That might be it.
Okay. Oh, this is another point I wanted to make is...
Yeah.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is doing this so much better than La La Land did. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend takes place like an hour from L.A. or something, and it is a modern musical that constantly references old musicals and old Hollywood and things like that, but is effective every single time. It has catchy songs. It has good singers. It has good dancing. Like, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is executing what La La Land tried to do at such a higher level that it's embarrassing, honestly, that La La Land exists. Because, like, there's a song in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend that is a direct reference to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Marilyn Monroe, you know, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. They're doing that, and they get it. They get that movie. They get that, like, song. They get that scene. They get that so perfectly. And they understand Hollywood I feel like, the correct level, because they have this tongue-in-cheek reference to it, but it's also still good music, you know? Yes. And I just think, let them do that and leave it alone, La La Land, because you can't. You can't. Like, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend works as a love letter to Hollywood, as a love letter to movie musicals. It works on that so much more effectively.
Mm-hmm. I would, if you're also looking for other things that execute this better, I would also put forward, like, a lot of people have seen Amelie, the 2001 French film. Another one that I think not enough people have seen and does pretty much the same premise, also fantastically, is Populaire, which was from 2012. And that has Romain Duris in it, and he's like a very, very popular French actor. And it's him and Deborah Francois, and she's a typist. She's a secretary in the 1950s in France. For him, he's her boss. And he realizes that she is a very fast typer. So he enrolls her in, like, these world championships to be the fastest typer in the world. And it has that, like, that Zooey Deschanel feeling, you know? Yeah. Like, that, like, very twee sensibility and the nostalgia of the 50s. And it is not a musical, but it has that, like, relationship of, like, he's kind of a dick, she's, like, a small-town girl, and it's a love story, and it's a comedy, and it is French and lovely, and I love that film so much, and I have made people watch it in the past, and I hope I continue to, because that is the type of film that La La Land should have been.
Right.
If they were going for that, that's what they should have tried to do.
Or I just thought, oh, it's a modern movie musical. Okay, so how are they going to make that modern? You know how? And I think Moulin Rouge is an amazing musical. Pitch Perfect is a good musical. Like, jukebox musicals, like, I feel like that is a great way to do a modern musical. I just think, the modern musical now is children's movies. It's Disney movies. It's Moana. It's Frozen. You know, stuff like that. And the reason why those succeed is because the music they created for those is catchy. It's good. You want to listen to it more. You remember it. And if you can't create memorable music, then do a jukebox musical. Like, just do better.
I actually agree. Like, jukebox musicals are very complicated, in my opinion, because of the Broadway theater aspect of my mind, and, like, a lot of people have a lot of resentment for them because they feel like it's a little bit cheating. I love them.
I think Jersey it's a difficult thing to pull off.
It is. Jersey Boys is one of my favorite
musicals. Across the Universe?
I love
That's
it.
Great.
I don't remember Across the Universe. It was the first date I ever went on was during the movie Aww. Across the Universe. Yeah. Anyway, so... but I do think this movie could have been a really good jukebox musical yeah. because you could have pulled all of the music from those movies that you want to reference mm-hmm. and use them in the scenes in like a Crazy Ex-Girlfriend right. sort of way, in a joking manner or like a referential manner. And that would have succeeded yeah. 1,000 times more than what they did yeah. with their two songs.
And even Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is not technically a jukebox musical in the sense that they're not just singing other songs.
The same song.
They're
right.
But they're doing a different genre of music every song they do, mm-hmm. thus keeping it so much more interesting. I think if you're trying to market this as a modern musical to modern audiences, that's the way to go. And it's like, of course he was turned down so many times for this movie, because it's garbage. You know, like, the script sucks, the music sucks. You know, so it's like, yeah, of course no one thought this would do well. The only reason it did well is because they just kept giving it awards.
Yeah. I did like John Legend a lot. He's very charming.
Yeah, he is.
I like him. I wish he would act in more things.
Yeah. I thought he was great, and I thought they were so dismissive of his character. And
yeah.
And I thought it was really insulting.
God. Was it just because he was a sellout? I don't know. I don't even want to talk about it anymore.
Like, is that even a thing, though? That's the thing. Like, why not examine that? Like, what does it mean to be a sellout? Because isn't that what she is at the end?
Yeah.
Like, and, yeah. and the idea that her one-woman show leads to her big break.
I know.
And that she just marries some guy we don't care about. Like, it's just like, why? It was one of those things where it was like, why did we watch this whole thing at the end? And they thought,
so
like, we're going to be deep at the end with this little weird, like, sliding doors thing
Montage.
Where we get to see it and it's supposed to make you sad. And instead I'm just like, okay, I don't care if those two get together. I don't care if these two get together. You know, like, to me, I didn't care about any of them.
Mm. I had a conversation yesterday with the harpist that's performing in our show that we're doing at the Museum of Art. And she was basically commenting on how working in a theater environment for her is so different because it's more of like a we're helping each other family atmosphere, and she works primarily in orchestras
mm-hmm.
and how the orchestra environment is dying. And she thinks it's because there's no support system built in like there is in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And she had this whole theory, and like this was in between two scenes of the show. We were just standing there waiting for our next cue. And she was telling me this whole thing. And I was like, this is fascinating. What an interesting, like, a side of the story I never really thought about. And now thinking about like La La Land, it's like exactly what you're saying. Like, who, like, why not tell something more like something with depth mm-hmm. that actually relates to how Hollywood is operating now?
Right.
Like, the nostalgia element is fine, but also like looking backwards is not helpful.
Right.
If you're not also growing forwards, mm-hmm. you have to be thinking about like how these young people coming to Los Angeles now are surviving on minimum wage, or like there's so many
right.
complicated themes that could be woven in.
Right. Instead of saying, oh, here's this guy looking back on the golden age of jazz and he's really missing it and he's saying, I gotta bring it back, and then succeeding. Like, how is that just like how she succeeds as well? It's this insane fairy tale in the end, mm-hmm. instead of telling you anything real or true about the modern world that we live in.
Mm-hmm. I will just say that this movie will not be, in my mind, a musical. Like,
no.
When people ask me about movie musicals, I will never list this in the ranks. I just want to say that.
No.
Flat out.
No.
Go watch The Last 5 Years instead.
Literally watch any other movie. I just, like, I feel so aggressive towards it because I think because they're so self-satisfied with themselves.
Yeah.
And he's so proud of himself. And it's like...
Yeah.
And he'll never know that it was an unnecessary piece of garbage.
Good for him. It's his passion project. But also, like, there are a lot of people that have passion projects that are probably more deserving.
Right.
And
it's like,
would've
you
said
would
something.
Think after 6 years you'd come up with a good song.
It's sad because the story is, like, he couldn't get financing for this film,
mm-hmm.
but he did get financing for Whiplash. So he did Whiplash first. Mm-hmm. And Whiplash is way better. Like, a lot of people still didn't like Whiplash that much, but I kind of liked Whiplash, and like Miles Teller being a horrible person in that movie worked really well.
Yeah.
And J.K. Simmons in that movie was great. And then to go from Whiplash to seeing this movie, it's like, like, this should have been your first movie, and then you should have done Whiplash.
Yeah.
Oh, what a shame. Well, I really hope it doesn't win all 14 Oscars.
I hope it wins zero. Like The Revenant, you know, where it was like, that was nominated for so many last year, and it's just like, it didn't win Best Picture. I don't remember the other ones.
Leo won Best Actor.
Which is, Amy Adams not being nominated this year is, we'll talk about that later, but,
okay.
It's bullshit. but I just hope it wins as few awards as possible.
Yeah. Well, who else is up for Best Actress against Emma Stone? Is it
Meryl Streep?
Some other people.
Viola Davis. Oh no, that's supporting.
Oh right, she's supporting. Yeah, just
bullshit. Is somebody from the whole movie is her.
Yes. Is somebody? Nobody from Hidden Figures is nominated, right?
I can't remember.
I don't think they are. I think I checked and I was upset.
To me, Hidden Figures is so obviously the best movie of the year.
Right.
And so. Yeah, it's just it's the best movie.
This is going to be, let's just say, this is going to be a part of our Oscars discussion.
Right, we're trying to slim down our Oscars episode by doing a couple movies on their own. And that's
right, in the lead up. So I think next week we're going to be talking about Moonlight.
Sure.
Right? Yes? Because that will be a much more positive discussion.
Yeah.
I think, because we both love that movie.
I liked it.
You liked it? You didn't love it?
Yeah, I don't know. It was one of those things where it was like Carol, and I walked out thinking I should have liked it more than I did, and it just sort of left me a little cold.
Yes, it was like Carol. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, well, we'll talk about it next time. But now you know how we feel about La La Land. Mm-hmm. I hope you feel the same, because if we just shit on a movie you really loved, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry if you really loved it, but I don't understand.
But if you did, tell us why. Tell us why.
Yeah.
I've only heard from one person who loved it, and it was the guy that seated me at the movie tavern when I went to see it. And I was like, oh, yes, I've been here before. I was here earlier today. I just saw something else, and I loved it, and I really don't want to see this. And he was like, oh, I really like this. I listened to the album on my way into work today. Whoa. And I was like, okay, that's a good sign. And then I was like, that's not a good sign.
That doesn't make any sense. I was so glad I saw it with my friend Hannah, because we walked out, and she was angrier than I was when we walked out. She was just like, they can't sing! I was like, yeah, you're right. And see, with me, I always second-guess my ear for music, because I always think, like, oh, I'm tone-deaf. I can't judge other people for their ability to sing or whatever. And then when she, who was in an a cappella group in college...
Like a real one.
Like, she really can sing. She was like, they were not good at singing. And I was like, oh, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I thought that... Her big number at the end, Emma Stone's big musical monologue or whatever at the end was so boring and
just go watch
screechy.
The last 5 years.
It just does nothing for me. Oh, boy. Now that we've ripped this to shreds, let's go into recommendations. What do you got for me?
I have a book that I just finished reading. I emailed you about it.
Yes, nice.
We started emailing.
He was discussing it on another round, I don't know, a year or two ago.
Oh.
And that was a great discussion.
Yes, this is Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, which is it's written to his son, his 15-year-old son, basically. Mm-hmm. And it is a beautiful window into everything about Ta-Nehisi. It's amazing. And I haven't read Black Panther written by him yet. Mm-hmm. And now, after reading this, I'm very excited to read Black Panther, because I think that I will have done it in the right order, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've now seen him as a writer first, which is important. But it's so interesting, and he talks about Howard, and it made me feel a lot about Smith, and he talks about traveling, which made me think about Ireland, and I think that it just is, like, a wonderful story, and also important, and it's framed so well. And as Toni Morrison wrote for the blurb on the cover, this is required reading. So, yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me.
Great. Yeah. Well, I have a double recommendation. One I already sort of emailed you about, but they're both in the same vein of these political times. Here's some required viewing. The first one is, I told you about, The Divided States of America, a Frontline documentary that aired last month. It was a two-night event, so it's long, but it's worth it, and you can break it up into the two parts. But basically, if you've seen other Frontline documentaries, you'll start to see, like, oh, I've seen this interview somewhere else. But what they do beautifully is they take the last 10 years of our political climate, and they sort of break it down as to what are the major things that happened that led us here today, sort of a thing. How did this populist movement come about, you know, that sort of thing. And they really, you start to see, oh my God, Sarah Palin really was this massive flashpoint that we didn't really realize at the time because we were too busy laughing at her. And then what was so fascinating that I hadn't really seen before was talking about Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan, these two sort of creators a bit of the Tea Party movement and facilitators of that, and how one ended up getting voted out of office and replaced with a Tea Party guy, and the other one becomes Speaker of the House, sort of a thing. And so it was so interesting how they introduced these tactics that really completely ground the government to a halt, and one benefited massively and one lost his job, sort of a thing. And so it's so fascinating to see the connective tissue of it all, and to really have a deeper understanding of what these last 10 years meant, like what happened, what Obama accomplished, and how he accomplished it. And so the Divided States of America, highly recommend that. It's on PBS, you can find it on their website, and then pretty soon it'll be on Amazon Prime. Cool. And then the second thing is Throwing Shade, the TV show. So Throwing Shade is one of my favorite podcasts I've been listening to for years, where a feminist and a gay man talk about women's and gay issues, but they're comedians. And so this show is on TV Land. Earlier we were talking about networks that you would have thought had certain things. And so now they have a show, Throwing Shade, on TV Land. And it's finding its footing, and it's getting better every single week. And I think it's already like appointment viewing, I would say, for, you know, like, because Sam B is only one day a week. John Oliver still is on vacation. So it's like, you still need some people to make fun of the news. Like, they have a whole segment just called Local Dicks, where they talk about, you know, like comptrollers and things like that. That's like, did you know this guy has been saying these awful things or whatever? And they throw in some like sketches in between that are really funny. So Throwing Shade, the TV show, highly recommend it. I think it's enjoyable.
I guess I didn't realize that it would be like a made weekly sort of thing. I thought it was like they recorded it all and releasing it as like a TV show. I didn't realize it was like news based topical.
It's topical. So, yeah. Yeah. It's great. Like a few days. It's like they film on a Friday. It comes out on a Tuesday. So that's it's awesome. Not like as immediate as Sam B is, but it's so great because they can adapt and change the show as things go on and get better. And so the show already it's been 3 weeks, I think, and each episode's gotten better. So
cool.
It's great. And I think people would really enjoy it.
Neato. Well, does Zach have anything?
He does.
All right.
This is exciting.
Congratulations. You didn't sneeze at all during this podcast,
by the way. I didn't sneeze. Just something in my kitchen fell down or something. I don't know.
Again.
Who knows? I'll look into that.
Say hi to that ghost when you find them.
Okay, I gotta get the volume up.
Hey, Becca. You know, I actually did see Heartbreakers and liked it way back in the day. I was a big Jason Lee fan, so I saw that movie because of him. And Jennifer Love Hewitt, of course, too, but we won't get into that. Anyways, not a business idea, but a joke I saw online. I can't take credit for it. I don't know who came up with it, though, but I thought it was too good to pass up, so here you go. Do you know that King Arthur didn't build his round table? Yeah, it was actually one of his knights, a lesser-known knight, Sir Comfrance. Yeah, I'll just let that sink in there. Okay, well, talk to you later. Bye.
Did you ever read that book? The kid's book about circumference?
No.
It's a book that teaches you about like circumference and his son Radius. And it's like about the building of the round table. And it's so good. And his wife Diameter.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
I guess I was the only one who had that book as a kid, but I love that.
Amazing. That might be my favorite Zach joke so far.
I gotta get you that book. You'll love it.
Okay, is it a kid's book?
Yeah, it's like he cuts a big tree down. Yeah, it's literally teaching you about diameter, like, because she's like the height of the thing, and his arm's circumference goes all the way around it, and the boy is half of the height of diameter, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to learn, so I'll pass.
Right.
But it sounds great.